make a reservation.
Hi, this is Meade Treadwell, Lieutenant Governor. And I'm here in Barrow, where it's overcast, but not too chilly. And we have two people who have shown up for the hearing here and a group online. So let me call the hearing to order.
Ed Flanagan just got off the phone. He said he'd be back in about 2 minutes.
Okay, that's good. Who is that? Is that Denny?
Hi, this is Denny DeWitt. I'm sorry, me.
Yeah, hey, Denny, how are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's overcast here as well.
Are you in Juneau today?
I am.
Yeah. Really good.
Okay.
I was just thinking whether I need a handheld.
I'm gonna test.
How far away you can be from?
How far away I can be from this microphone? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Okay. That's great.
Stand by the screen and see how. I think the distance is 75 feet.
Now I'm standing by the screen. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you, but it's getting more difficult to understand you.
Okay, so you can walk around.
That's right. Good deal.
And maybe this evening, because you'll have maybe more people, I'll get you a handheld mic, and that'll help too.
Okay.
Okay.
Good deal. Yeah, since Ed will be up first, I'll wait till Ed gets back. Ed, are you back yet?
Yes, I am, Lieutenant Governor. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
And let me again have the names of the folks who are online from the Department of Labor.
My name is Joe Dunham. I'm the supervisor of the Wage and Hour Administration within the Department of Labor. I'm here just to answer questions if they arise.
And this is Dan Robinson, Research and Analysis, Department of Labor.
And Dallas Hargrave, Commissioner's Office, Department of Labor.
Thanks, fellas, for being online. I think we'll get through this hearing fairly quickly, but there others know that they can call in, and we're doing what the law requires, and I just did a radio interview in Barrow here about this and the other hearings that we're doing today and tomorrow. Let me just say that our agenda for the hearing today is that I'll present on the bill, a cost estimate on the bill that was prepared by us in state government. And then we will invite Ed Flanagan as representing the sponsor of the bill to give a sponsor statement for 10 minutes. Denny DeWitt, who's with the National Federation of Independent Business, will give a response statement, a con statement for 10 minutes. Then we will open up to testimony and questions by individuals, including yourself here. Then we will, there may be other questions that are posed for the record. We'll go from there. But this public hearing is a public hearing on ballot measure 3, which is an act to increase the Alaska minimum wage. And I'm going to be speaking from a PowerPoint presentation, which can be found on the Alaska Online Public Notice System. And the online public notice system can be easily reached at alaska.gov. A very fast summary of the bill. This bill would increase Alaska's minimum wage from its current level of $7.75 an hour to $8.75 an hour effective January 1st, 2015, and to $9.75 an hour effective January 1, 2016. And thereafter, the minimum wage in Alaska would be adjusted annually for inflation. It would create a method for an annual inflation adjustment, but if that method does not yield a state minimum wage that is at least $1 higher than the federal minimum wage, it would require the minimum wage to be at least $1 over the federal minimum, and tips or gratuities would not count toward the minimum wage. A sectional analysis of the proposed bill The two-page act would repeal and reenact Alaska Statute 23.10.065A and require the minimum wage in Alaska be raised by $2 in two installments over the next 2 years from $7.75 to $9.75 by January 1st, 2016. It has a method for calculating annual adjustment for inflation after 2016, and if the minimum wage were determined by the proposed annual adjustment method to be less than a dollar over the federal minimum wage, the minimum wage shall be set at a dollar over the federal minimum wage. Let me just say that that's a fairly simple, straightforward bill. There are not too many issues as far as how it would be implemented. The issues that we heard in the previous hearing are more along the questions of its effect on the economy, its effect on jobs, and so forth, and we'll hear from the pro and the con side on that. But to tell you how a citizen initiative happens, to the individuals here and listening online, this is a case where we, the people, are the legislators, not the legislators themselves, but you, in essence, are holding this hearing so that you can ask questions about a law that's up before you to pass, not your elected legislators. This law, if it does pass, is not subject to veto. It may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date, according to the Alaska Constitution, Article 11. And although the legislature may amend an initiative at any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or vitiate the intent. So, for example, the legislature could not come along and change the number substantially higher or lower, some people might argue, because this is set by initiative. Now, you know, those arguments sometimes have occurred in the courts after an initiative passed, but that's what we've learned from the courts and the Constitution. And you can see there's a number of cases there. The law requires me as Lieutenant Governor to ask the Department of, or the Office of Management and Budget to go to all of our cabinet agencies and figure out what the cost estimate of the bill is. And we did that at the time that the sponsors circulated the signatures. The cost estimate showed us that the cost of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development was $2,083, and that cost was primarily for printing 5,000 posters on the summary of the Wage and Hour Act, 5,000 Know Your Rights child labor brochures, and 1,500 Alaska fishing industry brochures. So it was essentially the cost for getting the word out about the minimum wage. There were some other costs in the multi-agency cost summary, primarily at the Office of Lieutenant Governor, where the cost per initiative to add this to the elections is about $71,000, and about $9,000 being the share of the cost of these hearings. So all told, a cost estimate of $82,340. As I mentioned on our agenda for the public hearing now, we will invite Ed Flanagan as representative of the sponsor group. And Ed, I'm going to ask you for the record to state the name of your sponsor group and who were the other sponsors of this initiative as you begin your presentation. Thank you for being with us today.
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity again. Again, always sorry can't be there in person, but would be rather cost prohibitive. And I assume our PowerPoint is up there now, Lieutenant Governor?
It is now up there, yes.
Okay, great. Yes, my name is Ed Flanagan, and I'm the chair of Alaskans for a Fair Minimum Wage. And we are the group that formed around March of 2013 specifically for the purpose of sponsoring this initiative to raise the state's minimum wage. My fellow sponsors, state law requires three sponsors, are, like myself, former state labor commissioners, Tom Cashin of Juneau and Jim Sampson of Fairbanks. And we formed the group, applied to the Lieutenant Governor's office, did the initial petitions to get approved to go out and collect the required 30,169. We actually got about 43,000 signatures and were approved for the ballot. I will just go ahead and go right to the PowerPoint in the interest of time here. And if you could just switch to the second slide, actually after the head page, what does ballot measure 3 do? The Lieutenant Governor covered that very well in his introduction, so I won't go ahead and repeat that. Just see right there, it's a fairly simple, straightforward bill, and it's also very similar to an initiative and legislation that passed in 2002, the last substantial increase in the state minimum wage. And what it does not do, one thing which some critics have brought up, they claim negative impact on teen employment, and we'll point out that Alaska has a long-standing exception to its state minimum wage law, that the law, and in this case this increase, would not apply to someone younger than 18, so a 16 or 17-year-old or younger, working 30 hours or less, is not even covered by the state minimum wage law. They fall under the federal law. So we'll go to the next slide, and a little history here. Alaska was the first state to establish its own higher minimum wage, higher than the federal minimum wage, which the law had been in effect since 1938. And this was done in our first state legislature, 1959. The federal minimum wage was a dollar. The Alaska legislature said, well, the Alaska minimum wage is going to be 50 cents over that. And that was the law for several decades. And that kept us the highest minimum wage in the state, which is certainly an appropriate understandable with our higher and relatively much higher than cost of living in Alaska. So Alaska had a 50% premium on the $1 federal minimum wage law right at statehood in 1959. Well, you can see we stayed number one right up until the early 90s. Some states started following our lead and passing their own higher minimum wages as the federal minimum wage, which had formerly, prior to 1980, had been Congress. It really was a bipartisan process. About every 5 years, they'd adjust the minimum wage. But it got stuck in the 80s, didn't go up for eight years during the Reagan presidency. And so states started to act on their own. And Alaska fell a little behind, but in 2001, Governor Knowles introduced a bill somewhat modeled on initiatives that had been done in Washington and Oregon to raise the minimum wage from what was then $5.65, 50 cents over the federal at the time, to $7.15, and to allow for cost of living increase so that it would go up a couple of percent, just 10, 20 cents a year, and keep pace with inflation. And also had a provision that if it was a higher amount, just like our initiative, as the Lieutenant Governor explained, would always be at least a dollar at the time of adjustment, would always be at least a dollar over the federal. So we kind of kept that relationship but upgraded it from what had been in law since 1959. Well, the legislature, for whatever reason, but presumably it turns out that they didn't want it on the ballot in the 2002 election. That was pretty clear. They passed a bill, identical bill, it pretty much had to be, to keep the initiative off the ballot, which was all well and good because it was identical. And on January 1st, 2003, the state minimum wage went up from $5.65 to $7.15. Unfortunately, in that same year, in 2003 legislative session, almost exactly a year to the day from when they had passed the bill, including the cost of living, the legislature repealed the cost of living provisions. And as a result, Alaska was stuck at $7.15 for 7 years until the federal minimum wage was actually embarrassingly about to pass the state minimum wage. So kind of a bad history there, and you can see where we've fallen in the slide I'm showing. We are now, although we're not the highest cost of living state anymore, of course anybody outside of Anchorage would disagree with that, but Anchorage determines a lot of what our cost of living is as a state, and it's, you know, much more reasonable there than to live in other areas than in other areas of the state, particularly rural and areas like Barrow. But you know, we are the fourth highest cost of living state now in the country, but you can see where we are in terms of minimum wage. We're down to 19th. We're behind even low wage and low cost of living states like Florida and Arizona. If we don't pass this initiative on January 1, we'll fall to 21st place. We'll even behind another low wage, low cost of living state, West Virginia. We don't have to be the highest, but we sure as heck shouldn't be 19th or 21st. And that just shows, next slide, please, just shows, you know, where we stand in terms of Hawaii, most expensive cost of living, then Washington, D.C., New York, and then Alaska. That's the most recent figures. Now, times critics or opponents of the minimum wage, and for years, minimum wage is probably, like I said, adjusted about every 5 years, and conservative economists and other critics would always warn of that you're going to cause disruptions and loss of jobs because you're pricing people out of the market. And that was an argument that went on every time the minimum wage was increased. And then finally, in the early 90s, some economists said, hey, you know, we've been doing this for, at that point, 50-some years. Did all that stuff they talk about ever happen? So they actually did some empirical studies. They actually looked at real jobs, not theory, not raise the price of A and this happens to B. They looked at what happened in the fast food industry in two adjacent counties in different states when the minimum wage was increased in one state and not the other. And they did an intensive study, in this case of fast food employment, fast food workers, and found that not only was there no job loss in this low-wage industry in the county with the higher wage, there was actually growth because more people, more low-wage workers in that county were able to afford to go to McDonald's or Burger King once in a while and actually increased employment. Now, in Alaska, we have a great case study. I mean, not a case study. We have great real-world experience, economic facts. And the Department of Labor, in their briefing during a March 29th hearing under this same process, a legislative hearing, pointed out this example of 2002-2003. Our minimum wage, because the legislature stalled and the increase...
Mr. Can I interrupt you just for a second?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What slide would you like us to be on at this point?
I'm sorry, I'm on job and wage growth. It is the fourth slide from the third after the title.
Okay.
Job and wage growth.
Thank you. If you just tell us when you want us to switch, we'll switch.
I apologize for that. Thank you for interrupting. I needed to be told that. Okay, so if we're looking at job and wage growth 2002-2003, you'll see what happened when Alaska's minimum wage overnight on, you know, New Year's Eve 2002 into New Year's Day 2003, the minimum wage went up 27%. It was going to be, under the initial bill, like our initiative, phased in over 2 years to lessen the impact or any disruption possibly to businesses. But in that case, the legislature had not passed it the first session, so it went in overnight. I have not found, I don't believe there is any case of a local or federal minimum wage going up that significantly, basically overnight. And what happened? In total employment, the total non-agricultural, non-farm employment, when any government or entity or says, talking about jobs created or how many jobs, we're talking about the total non-farm employment. It always excludes military, fishers, crew share people, and self-employed. Folks like that, but the big wage number is always the total non-farm. And for Alaska, the average monthly employment in 2003 was 1.5% higher than in 2002, definitely similar to subsequent growth and in prior years in that time period. The average monthly wage went up 1.7. Private sector employment, 1.7 increase in the employment, and 1.5% in the average monthly wage. But look at the four main low-wage employers, industries employing low-wage workers that were identified by the Department of Labor. Seafood processing, employment up almost 6%. Retail trade up slightly, but up 0.6%. Accommodation, hotels up 5.6%. Food service and drinking places, despite dire warnings that the lack of a provision in our law for employers of waiters and waitresses to pay them less than the minimum wage, that employment was up in keeping with the same rate as the total private sector. And, of course, the wages in these industries were up because the minimum wage paid to many of their workers was up. So you had a 27% increase in the minimum wage. The quantity of jobs was up, and the quality of jobs in terms of pay was up. We think Alaskans will take that deal any day of the week. Now, who's affected? These are Department of Labor numbers for the directly affected, those who were projected to be making less than $975 in 2016 when that raise takes effect, 28,000. Then you always do an indirectly affected number because there is a trickle-up or spillover effect as employers and industries adjust wage scales. And this is a conservative estimate of just $1, the folks making $1 more than what we're raising it to on January 1, 2016. Done by the Economic Policy Institute, and that's another 20,000. So 48,000 Alaskans and their families stand to benefit from this wage increase. And they're not all kids. 20 and over, 78% of them, you hear a lot about, oh, it's all teenagers. It clearly is not. 78% of those 48,000 are 20 and will be 20 and over. Women are 57%, and 25% are raising children. I'm sorry, I forgot again. This is on the who is affected slide. If you hadn't caught up with me yet there, I apologize for not changing. The next slide now, moving to percentage change in employment by state. That's kind of a hard one to read, but basically that's a comparison. The 13 states, because they have, most of them, because they have CPI adjustments like we propose, and also New Jersey, which passed a law last November, substantially increasing their minimum wage. In those states, all but one of them, all but Jersey, had job growth in comparing the last 5 months of last year under the old wage to the first 5 months of this year under the new wage. That was higher than the average around the country. Now, if we could switch to the next slide, one reason that it's important to raise the minimum wage, and sometimes critics will say, oh, they're going to pass the cost on to the consumers, which in part they will, but you've got to realize we're already paying. We're subsidizing employers of low-wage workers. Public assistance for Walmart employees, not picking on them, but they happen to be the largest employer in the country with 1.1 million or more employees. Those employees receive $6.2 billion in federal public assistance, either Medicaid, child health program, earned income tax credit, food stamps. Fast food workers get nearly $7 billion, as you can see there, between Medicaid, earned income tax credit, and food stamps. And 52% of families of frontline fast food workers receive public assistance as compared to 25% of the workforce as a whole. So the taxpayer is paying that, and that's because we're really encouraging and keeping those wages low for those employers by paying their adding to the paltry wages they receive to enable them to survive. The earned income tax credit, not to belabor that, but a lot of times, and in other forms, we've had people say, oh, you should just increase the earned income tax credit. That's a better mechanism than the minimum wage. And the earned income tax credit is a great program. It does give money to low-wage workers. It is an incentive to work. But that is a very expensive program, costs $56 billion a year. And the average family benefit, I'm on the earned income tax credit slide, is for a family with children is less than $3,000 a year. And that would equate to $1.40 an hour for a full-time worker. It would cost, so you can imagine what it would cost nationally to try and equal a $2 increase in the minimum wage over time. It would be billions of dollars, which would have to come from somewhere, and it would probably, based on debates that have happened in the last few months in Congress, come from food stamps, another program. So what this ballot measure means, just to put it in some perspective, instead of working a family, if you have a single parent with two children, right now they have to work 61 hours at Alaska's minimum wage to just reach the federal poverty level. Well, with this modest increase, they're still going to have to work their butt off, but it'll be 49 hours a week instead of 61. They'll have some time to spend with their family and take care of other needs. So basically, we believe that Alaskans will again, and polls indicate this, will again see that it's important to make sure that work pays and that hardworking Alaskans in some of our toughest jobs at least get enough to have some chance of working their way out of poverty. And the critics who charge that, you know, there's going to be impacts on employment, they have nothing to rebut the experience, the empirical real-world experience of Alaska in 2002 and 2003. Much has been made of a survey back in February by the early March by the Congressional Budget Office saying that nationally the minimum wage might impact 500,000 jobs nationally, 0.3%. I would just cite that Goldman Sachs, which is one of the, if not the largest investment banking firm in the country, not exactly a tool or a foil for the labor movement or working people, they addressed that CBO study and said that, in our view, the CBO's recent estimate of a 500,000 hit to the level of employment, 0.3%, is likely a bit toward the upper end of reasonable estimates, both because many studies find no significant impact of minimum wage hikes on employment and because the offsetting boost to demand is likely to be larger than usual at present. They also said with regard to inflation, for any claims that, this one's really startling, a minimum wage hike might also boost inflation, but probably only very modestly. Hikes since 1990 have not been associated with discernibly higher inflation, and even if all employment cost increases were passed on to consumers, the resulting increase would probably not boost inflation by more than 0.1% per year, one-tenth of a percent. Do I have one more minute? I'd go over, Lieutenant Governor.
Ed, we'll give you one more minute. We'll give Denny one more minute.
Okay, that sounds great. Yeah, I'll just close with a little story because a lot of folks you know, say that, well, you're going to hurt small businesses. Well, I had an interesting afternoon. I collected a few thousand signatures myself on this initiative, and it was very interesting. It was a great way to talk to a lot of Alaskans about fairness issues and the economy in general, and really all over the state, and including some of the most conservative areas in the state. People really were in a hurry to sign it and often as not told us that we weren't going high enough. But I had an interesting afternoon in Sitka, not one of the more conservative areas in the state, but I was in Sitka collecting signatures downtown. And within the space of 2 hours, I had three different people sign the petition. One, first one identified herself as a small business owner with a gallery. There's a lot of nice art galleries right downtown Juneau, and a lot of them stay open year-round, unlike some other towns. And she said, well, she had a business there in Sitka, and she also had a business in Skagway seasonally during the summer for tourists. And she said, yeah, I'll sign that. She said, I pay my people. I start people at 15. How can I expect somebody to live in this town? And it's very expensive there, just like a lot of Alaska, on even $10 an hour. There's just no way. And not within an hour, I'd say another gallery owner, probably in the same block, they're all right around the cathedral there in downtown Sitka, she signed, said basically the same thing. Well, I don't see how you could pay anybody less than $10, you know, even to start here in Sitka. And then within, I'd say, another hour or less, I had a young woman come up and, oh, let me sign that thing. She says, I'm making $7.75 an hour, and I can't live on it. I said, oh, yeah, where do you work? Oh, I work at this gallery. And she pointed across the street. So here are three businesses in the same block, in the same industry, and two employers, high road employers, are paying the most they can to support, you know, allow their employees to support themselves in the town. And they're potentially or really suffering a competitive disadvantage against another employer who pays only what the law requires. The minimum wage puts a floor under the wage system. The free market still works above that floor, but unfortunately our Alaska minimum wage has become the floor of a sub-basement at its current level. Thank you very much.
Ed, thank you. We're now going to put up the PowerPoint. Do we have a PowerPoint from Denny?
We do not.
Okay, Denny, Denny, you're with the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Please talk about your organization at the beginning of your presentation, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, for the opportunity to provide our testimony on Proposition 3 on the November ballot. My name is Denny DeWitt. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business here in Alaska. We represent about 2,000 small businesses in Alaska. And we oppose Proposition 3, as it is not in the best interest of Alaskans it is intended to affect. Make no mistake, should Prop 3 pass, it would have two immediate effects, but not the one supporters would have you believe. First, teenage unemployment will increase over time, reducing their chances of getting valuable work experience. Prop 3 supporters point to Washington State as an example of an example Alaska should follow. In 2013, both states had similar unemployment rates, 6.5% here in Alaska and 7% in Washington. But for young adults ages 16 to 19, the situation was much different. In Alaska, where the minimum wage is $7.75 an hour, teen unemployment was about 17.5%. In Washington State, where the minimum wage is $9.32 an hour and rises every year because of indexing to inflation, the teen unemployment rate was an astounding 30.6%. In Oregon, the minimum wage is $9.10 and the teen unemployment rate is 27.4%.
A loss of opportunity at the bottom rungs of the career ladder is concerning not just because teens miss out on spending cash, but also teens who miss out on early career experience are at a distinct disadvantage. For instance, research has found that seniors in high school with part-time jobs are earning higher wages 6 to 9 years after graduation than their counterparts who don't work. Lengthy spells of unemployment have also been shown to increase the risk of future unemployment for young people. In this regard, the last thing Alaska should be trying to do is emulate the youth unemployment rates in Oregon and Washington State. Second, the ability of low-skilled workers to earn income, especially those assisting seniors with errands and chores around the house, would be drastically cut, harming two groups of people at once. Elderly Alaskans on fixed incomes will be forced to reduce the amount of goods and services they can afford. This will be particularly devastating to those who are hiring casual helpers to assist with household chores they are no longer able to do for themselves. Data shows that families earning at least three times the poverty level are more likely to benefit than those earning below it, making minimum wage increases a lousy anti-poverty initiative. These results are not a matter of speculation, but economic patterns that have followed every increase in the minimum wage. It is vital that voters know the truth about the minimum wage. 99% of all hourly workers in Alaska already earn above the minimum wage. More than 50% of the minimum wage earners are under age 24, so raising the rate removes the first rung of the economic ladder of life for young adults, as business owners are forced to cut back on hiring in order to meet the cost increase. After the last federal increase in the minimum wage, 500,000 teenage jobs disappeared the following 6 months, and that was in a period of economic recovery when more jobs should have been available. The average annual family income of those earning minimum wage nationally was actually over $48,000 a year. Significantly more people earning at least three times the poverty level will benefit as those living beneath it. 83% of minimum wage earners are teenagers living with working parents, adults, or dual income couples. What happens when minimum wages rise too high? Well, you remember filling station attendants? How about baggers at grocery stores? And for those of us older folks, ushers in movie theaters. All have been eliminated. Technology may do the same for today's minimum wage jobs. We're placing orders through touch screens and self-checkout as it's growing here in Alaska. Losing those jobs means losing the bottom rung on the career ladder and fewer opportunities for people who used to fill those jobs. Of course, other factors besides the minimum wage can determine teen unemployment rates. But a careful look at the data shows that a higher minimum wage has played a role. Using data from 2005 through 2011, economists from Miami and Trinity University estimated that over 4,300 fewer teen jobs in Washington State due to the higher minimum wage. One article in Seattle Weekly provided a striking example of how these jobs are eliminated. Restaurants in the state's largest city have generally stopped hiring busboys. That's where I started, opting to have servers bus their own tables instead, and are scheduling fewer servers per shift due to the higher cost. These consequences are broadly consistent with what we see in the economic research on minimum wage increases. Since the early 1990s, roughly 85% of the most credible academic studies on this subject show that a higher minimum wage reduces employment for the least skilled and the least experienced employees. That doesn't mean that there aren't outliers, but they're in the distinct minority. As was mentioned earlier, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office understood this, and that's why it estimated a half million lost jobs nationwide from a proposed $10.10 an hour federal minimum wage. An unfortunate reality we must recognize is that small employers, those most affected by the minimum wage, cannot support employees that are not bringing to the business a value equal to their compensation. Small businesses are providing unemployment insurance, workers' compensation insurance, Social Security employer tax at a minimum, in addition to the basic salary. In addition, over half of these employers are providing additional benefits such as health insurance. As the total employee cost increases, businesses have to look to mechanization and computerization in order to stay in business and not end up ending employment for all its employees at any compensation rate. Given the reality of whom the proposed increase in the minimum wage will hurt, the young starting their lives and the seniors in the sunset of their lives, we can only hope and recommend that Alaskans vote no on this perhaps well-meaning proposal. It's not the intent we'll be voting on. It's the actual effect on the young and the old. Economist William J. Dennis, who's been studying small businesses and the minimum wage for nearly 40 years, asked an interesting question. Employers want experienced workers. How do you get experienced workers when you price people out of the market in the first place? Thank you for our opportunity to share our position with you.
Kenny, thank you for your testimony. At this point, I'd like to invite anyone who's here to make a statement and actually to use your prerogative as a legislator overseeing these laws to ask questions either of the proponent or the opponent or of the experts from the Department of Labor that we have online. Sir, could you identify yourself for the record and please go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Duke Marl. I'm a pastor here in Barrow. I have a question for the proponent. To talk about a minimum wage here of $7 or $8 or $9 or $15.75 here in the North Slope doesn't mean much. Our cost of living is so high that an effective minimum wage is much higher than that. But many states have gone ahead and in certain urban areas, certain cities have set their own minimum wages higher than the state. Is that something that could be done here in the state of Alaska, and how would that happen if this were to pass?
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Pastor. Yes, I understand that the state minimum wage, even if we were to go higher than $9.75, would probably not even be equal to the de facto minimum wage that you couldn't expect anybody to work for in a lot of the high cost of living rural areas in the state. But this concept is a state minimum wage. It has to apply to the whole state, and you have to set an amount that is going to apply to all areas. And as you said, a lot of you see more and more of these municipalities. Of course, everybody's familiar with the Seattle recent experience where they took the big leap compared to other so-called living wages. They kind of differentiate. I would differentiate between, although certainly $9.75 is more livable than $7.75, it still doesn't get you out of poverty. You're still going to need the earned income tax credit and other assistance. But a higher municipal-based living wage is a possibility under Alaska law. This provision would in no way encourage or discourage that. That would be done, separately by a local legislative body, city council or borough assembly, if it were to be done. And I think given our cost of living, Anchorage is not a cheap place to live, but it is a lot cheaper than everywhere else in the state, that it might be something that communities would want to look to in the future. But our proposal just addresses the longstanding statewide minimum wage. So it's not apples and – well, it is. It's a wholly separate issue, but I understand what you're saying, and at some point in the future somebody may, some town or city or borough, may in fact want to think about doing a local ordinance to create a local minimum wage.
So I also redirect the question to the folks at the Department of Labor, either Joe or Dallas or Dan? Are you aware of any municipality that's had a local minimum wage?
I'm not aware of any in Alaska.
No, I'm not either. This is Dan.
And the next question I'd have is, or just to follow up on that, Denny, would you like to make any comment on any of that?
No, thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify or speak?
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell. My name is Forrest Uliman. I serve on the Northville Borough Assembly, but I'm here as a citizen of Alaska. I'm a lifelong resident of Alaska, and I'm in favor of raising the minimum wage, whether the current amount or higher in the future. But it would seem that given the presentation of the slide earlier, that there seems to be a sense of redundancy, is that the obligation of the employer to pay a fair wage for those that are demographically disadvantaged. And it would seem to me that regardless of what wage is agreed upon, there should be some type of legislation that addresses the demographic disadvantage, because the minimum wage certainly tends to those that are on the road system versus those that are not on the road system. And I don't think there's enough that is done to regulate the cost of transportation, not only for passenger travel, but for freight and postal services. The cost in the rural communities that are not tied to the road system is enormously high, as you guys are well aware of. So when we start talking about the poverty level, the federal poverty level, it really doesn't equate to if every small business or any business for that matter that operated in the rural system that wasn't tied to the road system were to pay that minimum wage in the rural areas, that would be barely enough to just pay for a roof over your head, let alone child care services, food on the table, utility bills. So I think when we start talking about minimum wage, and as Pastor Duke pointed out, that the cost that is associated with complementing what we need to have healthy communities, and we don't see enough of a push to make sure that all employers, let alone employees, are paid what I think is fair as to the rest of the state of Alaska. And given, you know, what resources that the state has and the low population that this whole state has, there's no reason why we shouldn't be number one in every aspect. And I think we need to pay more attention to, because, you know, I can see that if there are employers forced to and I don't mean this in a bad way, but to pay a fair minimum wage demographically, I don't think there would be enough of a regulation to where not everything goes up automatically because they see this extra source of revenue that they need to get their hands on, whether it be the retail society or any aspect of that. I think in order for our people throughout Alaska to be able to live the American dream just like everybody else, they need to be given, rather than public assistance, I think you'll find that most Alaskans will want to work as hard as they can if they know that they're going to get ahead to be able to buy their own house, build their own home, buy all the modern amenities to make their lifestyle healthy. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you, sir. Do you have any questions for the experts?
Not at this point. I just would like to say that I think this is, I know that every several years this issue comes up, but I think this is a long time coming, and I just support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I make another comment? This is Pastor Morrow. I, for one, will be supporting this initiative when I go to the ballot box in November, because I think it's a step in the right direction. However, following up on what Forrest said, we need to have something more comprehensive that covers all the people in the state specific to their particular situations, their demographics. And maybe that's the next step. I don't know.
So, gentlemen, I should say at the last hearing we had on this matter, we talked a little bit about the demographics around the state. And because we have Joe Dunham here and Dan Robinson and Dallas Hargraves, I'm going to pose the question again that we posed the other day, which is, right now you set the cost of living index just based on Anchorage and not based on any sort of cost of living around the state. Can you explain why we do that? And then I'm going to ask Ed Flanagan to tell us why they had the cost of living raise only in Anchorage and not other parts of the state in his proposal.
Yeah, this is Dan Robinson. I'd be glad to field that question. The Consumer Price Index is produced by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's a very complicated process. They take a market basket of goods and services and compare changes in prices over time, and there are fewer than 30 cities in the nation where an index is produced, so it's not at all uncommon for it, and a lot of states don't have a single city. There's a national index and other ways to measure inflation, but it's just It's the complication of the process is the reason it's not done everywhere. And that, I think Ed Flanagan talked last time about how some measures use national index because when you're measuring inflation, it does tend to follow a national pattern, housing being the exception.
And I guess I would ask the question, I've certainly read statistics. I'm not sure if they were prepared by the Department of Labor that talk about the disparity in fuel and heating costs around the state. I mean, in Barrow, you've got a gas field, but in several other North Slope communities, you don't. In Anchorage, we had gas that was on long-term fixed-price contracts until only recently when the gas prices have doubled. But, you know, in Healy, the coal price has not gone up as quickly, as fast. So when you have those kind of disparities, do you trust the statewide average that you get out of Anchorage?
Well, it's we're the first to acknowledge that there are big disparities around the state to the tune of almost twice as expensive in some parts of the state where people live. The issue here is really whether there's a another inflation measure that could be used, and this is whether a, I guess a minimum wage would be practical with lots of geographic difference. But from my perspective, as the person with access and familiarity with the data, as an inflation measure, the Anchorage CPI really is Anchorage CPI or the U.S. CPI, the only very likely source of objective, robust data to be used for a purpose like this.
Yes, Lieutenant Governor, this is Ed responding to your part of the question for me. basically, similar answer to Dan's. The Anchorage CPIU is what we have, and in a sense, we're lucky to have it. As Dan said, there's only 30 municipality regions or like that urban areas that have their own. If we were lumped in with a Northwest as the best we could get, as opposed to the federal CPI, it would definitely be problematic. It would not reflect our different costs. I empathize with the comments of the folks in Barrow. I lived all my time in Alaska and Juneau and Fairbanks, and we think it's expensive compared to Anchorage where we live, but then we hear about or experience what folks out in Barrow and Nome pay for things, and it's as Dan said, it's a whole level higher than where we consider is higher than Anchorage. In the past, just briefly, I mean, and the Anchorage CPIU, it's very common in private sector and public sector collective bargaining agreements and in other state formulas, I believe, or federal formulas, as the best we have to use for the state as a whole. In Fairbanks, I've been in negotiations as a union representative in the past where I was trying to address the very same thing that the gentleman from Barrow have talked about, and I posed to Dan's colleague, Neil Freed, labor economist for the department in Anchorage, well, why can't I take the CPI and then take the differential between Anchorage and Fairbanks that's established elsewhere and put a percentage on top of that? And they're like, the email I got back was in capital letters. You can't do that, Ed. So it kind of strains the credibility of the numbers. And while in a perfect world, we would have more localized CPI measures, we've got to work with what we have, and that's certainly the case with the initiative.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify or pose questions? I have two other, one other question that I'd like to, kind of get on the record, and this is also for the Department of Labor folks, and in Ed's presentation, he gave some statistics about what happened in Alaska the last time the minimum wage went up. And I guess my simple question is, Ed, that was, and Ed, you and Denny are also obviously welcome to comment on this. You showed that the year that we had a 27% increase in the minimum wage, that we had monthly employment go up and the average monthly wage go up. So, in other words, unemployment didn't go down. Did there? That was between 2002 and 2003 when the wage increase went in effect in 2003. Did that trend continue, or did you see any? And I'm going to ask the Department of Labor guys. Do you know? Was this trend affected in any way, or did you, in your doing your statistics, ever note any relationship between the minimum wage and employment?
Yeah, this is Dan. We did not, and the minimum wage studies that have been done everywhere quite often faced a similar issue, which is that there are always lots of things happening in an economy, most of which or in sum will add up to much bigger factors than minimum wage increases. So it's tremendously difficult to isolate the effect of something like that. So it doesn't reveal itself as this part of the increase was affected by minimum wage, but and we did continue to see job growth. To the first part of your question, Lieutenant Governor, clear up until the recession hit in 2009.
Okay. The largest monthly wage increase on Ed's slide was for seafood production, preparation, and packaging that went up 8.1% in terms of a monthly wage. So at the same time, have we lost jobs to China in terms of seafood processing? I know that we're shipping more and more whole fish now in the round, and is that due to wage rates or energy costs or what has happened there?
Yeah, we regularly look at the causes, but there's always a degree of speculation to that, and our biggest contribution is in the actual numbers themselves. We can and do speculate a little bit on causation behind the changes, but again, that's something that would be open to a lot of disagreement among the various experts. So we couldn't say X percent of this increase or decrease was due to this specific factor, and nobody could with any precision.
Okay, and Danny or Ed, has there been any discussion with seafood processors on the likely effect of this wage hike on our industry that you're aware of?
This is Danny.
Go ahead, Danny.
Go ahead, Ed. Okay, I'll go.
You go.
My understanding is that Vince O'Shea from the seafood processors intends to testify in Juneau. My understanding is they're very much opposed to this for many of the reasons that you raised, but I can't speak on his behalf.
Okay, and this is Ed, and that's the first I've heard, because this, there was a lot of talk during the legislature, not only on the initiative, but on the bill attempting to preempt it, and industries that had in the past been very vocal against the minimum wage, primarily the restaurant, bar, and liquor industry, and seafood processing and some tourism employers, were strangely quiet. There was no stated opposition when a bill was being considered that would have done the same thing, and I'll be interested to hear what Vince has to say. With regard to jobs going over to China, we addressed that in a forum that was in Anchorage a while back, and somebody raised that, this would provoke that. But I think, jobs that are going overseas have pretty much already gone over there. To the extent that fish can be processed over there, you're never going to beat the labor cost of, in some cases, a slave Army Red Army slave labor camp in China. I mean, talk about a race to the bottom. Seafood processors out in Dutch Harbor, I was kind of shocked when I met a seafood processor down in Ketchikan when I was collecting signatures, who goes out in the winter and works out there in the pollock, multi-billion dollar pollock fishery. And I said, what are they paying out there these days? Because it's been 12 years since I was labor commissioner. They used to pay a little bit over the minimum, not much. He said, we just get $7.75 an hour. I said, you're kidding. And it's your first year? He goes, no, it's my third year. But they charge us $5 a day less for room and board every year we come back. So that's your minimum wage worker in a lot of cases, working in a very lucrative industry, whatever their foreign competition might be, working in a tough industry for $7.75 an hour, whether they're there 1 year or 4 years.
Thank you.
Might I make a quick comment?
Yes, please.
Again, this is Denny. Relative to the legislation that was introduced, I think it would be a huge, huge mistake for anyone to reference anybody's position on that particular bill relative to how they felt about how minimum wage would affect their particular industry. Or employees. For example, Vince Beltrami, who we know to be a very active union labor leader, opposed that. So I think that any characterization of what one would expect on this initiative relative to how they might have addressed that legislation, which was a little strange, would be wholly misleading.
Well, the AFL-CIO opposed it, Denny, because it was a clear attempt to keep it off the ballot so it could be amended like it was in 2003 and gutted a year later. But I appreciate
your position, but I don't believe that your opposition...
Why were the industries quiet, or in the case of Char, even supportive of the bill?
I would say that there are a whole lot of political issues that floated around that which flavored yours just as it did others.
You're making our point for us. You're vindicating our position.
Well, I just think that that has nothing to do with the impact of minimum wage on Alaskans who will be affected.
Thank you. And the last question I had is, again, this is just prompted by your slide, Ed, and because we've got the Dan Robinson with the research group here. You estimated that there are 28,000 people who make less than $975, of which 78% of them are 20 or over. So some of them may not be affected by this if they're under 18. And 20,000 indirectly who make between $975 and $1075. I guess the first question for Ed is do you see the affected indirectly, those who are being paid higher than minimum wage, as do you see their wages going up also because their wages may be based on some floor on what minimum wage is?
Yeah, that is, and Dan can probably speak to this, but that's a pretty recognized phenomenon. In fact, when the minimum wage went up slightly to avoid being passed in Alaska by the federal in 2009, there was a story in the Daily News, and they went around, I think it was one of the small restaurant chains, and basically employers said, yeah, when the minimum wage goes up, if I have a employee who is making $9.75 the day that it goes to $8.75, and they go from making a dollar over the minimum to making the minimum wage, I'm invariably going to adjust it upwards. And it used to be a rule of thumb, at least in 2002 when we had a lot of discussion on the last major reform, that a dollar above, at that time, $5.65 or $7.15 that we raised to would be kind of the area, the range, where you would see some trickle-up effect as wage scales were adjusted upward. CBO actually used, I believe, $1.60 over $10.10 in their analysis of the federal proposal to go to $10.10 per hour over 3 years. So the range, the dollar over, $9.75 to $10.75, utilized by Economic Policy Institute to come up with the 20,000 indirect that we show on the slide, is I think would be considered fairly conservative for impacted folks, indirectly impacted folks.
Dan, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I'll just say that our what we've done is looked uniquely at the specific number of people who make minimum wage under the current level and who would make minimum wage under the various combinations of proposals, federal and state. We didn't attempt to do an indirect, although certainly you would expect some kind of trickle up. If you've got some kind of hierarchy of wages and you raise a minimum wage at the lowest end, you would expect that. That, again, would be difficult to measure with any precision and not something that we undertook for this analysis.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any others either in the room here or online who'd like to make any additional comments or testimony? Pastor, one more time.
Come November, we're going to be voting on this up here. And frankly, the numbers don't mean anything to us. And I guess the concern I have about that is that it seems to me a way of further alienating citizens of both the North Slope and many of the rural areas of Alaska, especially indigenous populations, from Anchorage. And I have a concern about what that message sends to people. So I'm just throwing that out there. I don't have a solution. I'm not really asking for an answer unless you got one.
Anybody would like to answer the pastor's challenge?
No, well, I guess I am. Just one thing, Pastor, and it may or may not apply to Barrow, but I know we've mentioned it. I mentioned it in the Nome hearing that I agree with what you're saying. The number is not going to have relevance for a lot of folks. It might for some servers and restaurants, even in high cost of living areas of the state where their base wage paid by the employer is the minimum wage. There is an issue in many rural communities where folks go into Anchorage to work and may well find themselves in the low-wage occupations that workers in which would benefit from this minimum wage increase. That's not directly on point, but it's something to consider.
Mr. Governor?
Yes, sir.
In hearing
Forrest is speaking now.
Thank you. In hearing the pastor and the gentleman responding, it would seem to me that sometime in the future, I guess between the passage of this in November, that a more comprehensive approach needs to be applied to where all Alaskans are given justice is a good word to apply here because it goes back to all this talk about the federal poverty line. And when they're measuring the federal poverty line, there again has nothing to do with our rural communities throughout Alaska. Because if you go and find poverty, you'll find it in our villages. And it's not fair to those people that probably live in near third world status. I'm not speaking to what I know as far as the North Slope goes, but other areas throughout Alaska that are even contemplating shutting a town down or shutting a village down because there's not enough of an economic base for the state or the federal or even just the local folks to subside. So I think when we take into consideration any kind of referendum that are going to be used to impact 40,000 Alaskans, we need to take more of a comprehensive look that will affect as much as we can when we're dealing with things like this. I remember when I was a high school kid, and I was so elated to get paid the minimum wage because when it was $3.75 an hour and it jumped up to $4.25, holy cow, I got a 50-cent raise overnight. And I was happy about that. But, that was back when mammoths were roaming the earth. And, we're in the 22nd century now, and cost of just living here is enormous, especially if you're unemployed. And we just need to take everything into consideration. That's why I feel that this is a very good proposition to have. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify or make comments?
This is Joe Dunham, Wage and Hour Administration. I just wanted to offer a couple of pieces of information strictly as facts. This is not pro, it's not con, that haven't been brought up. One is there are a couple of other wages that are dependent on the minimum wage. For example, school bus drivers in public schools, they're required to get twice the current minimum wage, so their wages would be affected. The other would be exempt employees who are paid on a salary basis. For example, executive, administrative, and professional, their minimum salary requirement is twice the current minimum wage based on a 40-hour work week. So again, it's just a fact that there's other people that are, even though they're not paid directly minimum wage, but their wages would be directly affected by the minimum wage change.
So, Joe, what you're saying is that the slide that Ed had of direct and indirect, does that suggest the number on indirect is higher or just, I mean, it was the Department of Labor who provided the 28,000 direct number, but a different institute that did the indirect, so you can't really speak to those numbers.
Yeah, well, this would be an indirect, I guess. It would be a direct change. I don't have the slide here in front of me. I'm just going by sound. So I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
Okay, there's a slide, and ultimately these slides will be up on the online public notice system. We didn't have them up from the last hearing, and we're working to do that right now. But Ed had a slide that says, and I'll just read it out loud, who is affected, 28,000 directly who make less than $9.75 an hour, and there's a footnote on that saying that comes from a Department of Labor estimate of unpublished data. And then 20,000 direct indirectly who make $9.75 to $10.75 an hour, and that's footnoted to a fellow named David Cooper at the Economic Policy Institute estimate. Leading to Ed's conclusion that there's a total of 48,000 Alaskans affected, and then he breaks that down into people who are 20 and over, 78%, 57% women, and 25% have kids. So I get the question that I have here is, you've just shown us one other place where the minimum wage is in essence a floor for other workers, even though and the question whether or not it's included in Ed's numbers. Was my question.
Yeah, that I'm not sure.
It's definitely not included in our numbers because our numbers on that, well, the Department of Labor's and economic policies, those are based on workers who will be making at or less than $9.75 on January 1, 2016, or in the case of indirect, between $9.75 and $10.75. So any school bus drivers impacted, that would be pretty tough to figure. Certainly some will get a raise when the minimum wage is increased, and theirs is, besides the exempt employees that Joe mentioned, is the only thing in state law which we have not changed, except our number increasing for the hourly rate will affect it of its kind in state law. But yes, because some school bus drivers in the state already make more than twice $9.75, but there would certainly be some, you know, in Juneau, I think they start at 16, more than twice the current minimum wage, but 50 cents more. So, yeah, that would be outside or additional to the numbers that we address in that slide with workers at the actual, not a doubled minimum wage.
Thank you for those comments. Are there any other comments or questions? So we just had another individual come in. Would you be interested in testifying on this bill, sir?
Yes. The numbers you got up there at 48,000 Alaskans. I'm making $9.75 and $10.75.
Let me first just ask you to state your name and your hometown for the record.
Larry Okamaya.
Larry Okamaya, citizen here in Barrow.
Common citizen.
And a really good guy from our earlier conversations.
Yep. The numbers I see up there, There's 48,000 Alaskans. That's 975 and 1075. Would they qualify automatically as in a poverty level?
The question was asked is whether the number that was put forward by Ed Flanagan, one of the sponsors of the initiative, is that there are 48,000 Alaskans who make less than $10.75 an hour. And the question asked by our speaker here is, how does that relate to the poverty level? Is there somebody on in the Department of Labor who could answer that question?
Yeah, this is Dan. There are different poverty measurements, and I think, and we are not the poverty experts. It would be more the people at Health and Social Services. So the poverty level is quite low. I won't get myself stuck any further, other than to say, poverty is not part of that measure. It's a specific minimum wage look without trying to account for poverty.
I can address that somewhat, Lieutenant Governor, if you like.
Yeah, please go ahead. Who's speaking?
That's Ed. The poverty level for a family of three, it's raised every year, and probably have it in the fact sheet we handed out, but it's for a family of three, it's around $23,000. To get a family of three on one wage earner working 40 hours a week, 2,080 hours a year, we would have to have a minimum wage in the neighborhood of $11.75, not $9.75. For a family of four, it would have to be another buck on top of that, I believe, $6,000 more for a family of four. So even the increase we are proposing, the modest increase, does not get a family of three on one full-time year-round salary, wage of $9.75 to the poverty level. But the earned income tax credit, which I mentioned before, would make up the difference and hopefully then some get the people over that. But that was a good question, sir, and this proposal does not claim to get folks out of poverty on a job alone at that wage, but at least it gets them halfway there from where they are now at $7.75.
Thank you. In our last hearing, Denny wasn't there, but NFIB, there the con side was represented by a different group or a different individual. And I guess there was a discussion at that point about whether or not minimum wage intent is to counter poverty. Most minimum wage workers are part-time workers who might be in school or something along those lines. And I guess a question for the Department of Labor folks here is, how do you view the minimum wage? Are most workers receiving it? Supplementing income while they go to school, or is it basic income for a large group of people, of the people that you've that are mentioned in these numbers here?
We do occasional research on multiple job holders, for example. The big challenge we have in talking about people making minimum wage is that employers aren't required to report how many hours they work. So that means we patch together the estimates of how many people making from some different surveys. So we don't kid ourselves that we know more than we do about the precision. We do know that for the occupations most likely to make minimum wage, they tend to be, the people in those occupations tend to be younger than overall and slightly more female. But to be able to say X percent are working some other job, or even specifically the age breakout, is just beyond the data's ability to say with any kind of usefulness.
Thank you. Is there any other comment or question to come before the hearing today?
You're right. Do I make 975 an hour? and a gallon of milk costs $11. Would that affect whatever's going on?
You know, the question was asked.
That would cover my daily needs.
Yeah. I mean, if your rate right now is $9.75 an hour, you're being paid $2 more than the current minimum wage.
No. If I was making $9.75 an hour,
yeah,
going to the store, and a gallon of milk cost $11.
Right.
And that all changed. So that things can get lower than an hour of work you do to get a gallon of milk. That's awfully wrong.
Thank you for your comment. You have one question from your comment would be to ask, how is there one kind of standard where the minimum wage, you know, usually over time has been about equal to a certain commodity, and I don't know if that's been looked at in the past, but
I can take a shot at answering that, or at least. Given some perspective on it, Lieutenant Governor, I can do it briefly. You hear a lot of talk about 1968 being the high watermark of the minimum wage in terms of purchasing power. If that minimum wage of 1968 nationally of $1.60 was just to keep up with inflation, it would be $10.77 an hour right now for the U.S. Alaska in 1968 was $2.10, which would be $11.20-some, I believe, if you had just adjusted that for inflation. And just real quickly, I entered the workforce in 1968, New York State. I think we might have had 5 cents higher than the federal. It was $1.65 an hour. You could buy 5 gallons of gasoline for that at that time. And you could buy, actually, milk and gas weren't the same price then. You could buy, I think, probably 3 gallons or 2 to 3 gallons of milk. So that'll give you some perspective in terms of a $7.75 an hour minimum wage right now, and not even to mention the horrendous prices you guys pay in Barrow for milk and gas, but what we're paying down here, you're lucky to get, you won't get 2 gallons of milk or gas for $7.75 an hour in Juneau.
Okay. Thank you very much. Unless there's any others who'd like to make comment, I'm going to call this hearing to a close. I'd like to thank those of you who came out today and those of you who are online. This is the second of a series of 8 hearings that we'll hold on this ballot measure. And our next hearing on this measure will be held next Tuesday in Juneau at noon on September 16th. I should say to anybody listening or anybody reviewing the recording of this hearing, you are very welcome to testify at 855-463-5009. For those of you who want to review the record of this hearing, you can find it at the Alaska Online Public Notice System, which is reached through the Lieutenant Governor's website. We are creating these hearings for the record because if the law does pass, sometimes courts and legislators go back and look at the record and listen to the record. Thank you all very much for being part of the hearing today.
Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt. You mentioned the next meeting is Tuesday. It's actually Monday, right? Monday the 15th at 4 o'clock.
I'm sorry, I was going, excuse me, I was reading from a from one related to the Bristol Bay hearing.
I'm sorry. That's okay.
It's Monday at 4 o'clock at the Thomas Stewart Building in Juneau.
Yeah.
Thank you for that correction.
Yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned, and I'd like to thank the staff, Lieutenant Governor's Office, Scott Merriweather in Juneau, Michaela Gertson and Cameron Eggers, who are here. And thank our hosts at the Inupiat Heritage Center here in Barrow. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thanks.